Pete is here, and he's got a guest here with him, so we're ready to rock and roll and find out what's happening inside the black box.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Are we cutting off Dave Brubeck here?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Always my favorite intro, though, Dave Brubeck. Great.
For all of your pharmaceutical
and now we're cutting the commercial
needs.
Already
Stop
early.
By Sandy Springs Pharmacy, your neighborhood pharmacy for over.
Didn't switch from cue to manual.
All right, and I have
a sleep deprivation.
It always is, Dave. Always is on Saturday morning at 9 o'clock. All right. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Inside the Black Box, Radio Sandy Springs' weekly program on science and technology, or as we like to think of it, science only funnier. Today, let me begin, I guess, by recapping last week's show. Last week, we talked about science and technology in the movies. And, of course, one of the movies we talked about was an old classic, The Forbidden Planet, which, along with more modern movies, one of my favorites, Stargate. And you can see links to these movies on the program website if you want. Deals with, you know, entire sets of technology based on new metals. Both those movies are based on that. And to that end, last week we actually talked about probably one of the newest metals that seems promising, element number 114. This is the highest known element in the periodic table that actually might be stable. And a science article recently published by some Russian scientists suggests that it is stable to the tune of approximately 30 seconds. Along those lines, just this last Tuesday, in the New York Times Science Times section, Russian and American scientists both claim that they have made the heaviest element ever, element 118. And, of course, because it doesn't have that stable number of protons and stable number of neutrons that element 114 has, it lasted for 1/1000th of a second. This is according to an article by James Glanz in the New York Times Science Times section. A team of Russian and American scientists said yesterday they had created the heaviest element ever seen in a laboratory. A small dab of matter that lasted for less than 1/1000th of a second, but would add an entry to the farthest reaches of the periodic table and suggest that strange new elements may lie beyond. I'm not convinced. What this essentially is this is that element that goes all the way to the right side of the periodic table, just under radon, that a lot of people think of as very, very stable because it's in that noble gas, inert gas column. But, in fact, the nuclei is not, and this is obviously indicated by the fact that it only lasted for 1/1000th of a second. What they're referring to is this island of stability that Glenn T. Seaborg, the Nobel laureate physicist, once claimed is way out there when we get just the right number of protons and neutrons. But given that 114, which has both stable numbers of protons and neutrons, only lasted for 30 seconds, I'm a little skeptical. Seaborg actually made so many of these heavy elements, he actually has an elephant, he probably has an elephant named after him, an element named after him, Seaborgium. And also in the news, the use of virtual science classes. This, according to an October 20th article from the New York Times by Sam Dillon, no test tubes, debate on virtual science classes. And in fact, this is replacing a chemistry or biology lab with a simulation on a computer. So when the internet was just beginning to shape up American education, according to Sam Dillon, a chemistry professor photographed thousands of test tubes holding molecular solutions and working with video game designers created a simulated laboratory that allowed students to mix chemicals in virtual beakers and watch the reactions. You might want to take a look at this October 20th New York Times article online and see whether or not you think it's a good idea. The pluses, of course, are for rural educational systems where they don't have the facilities to actually carry out real biological and real chemistry labs. The minus is that you really don't get a feel for what these things look like. And when we bring our guest Nick Hutt on in just a moment, I'm sure he'll validate the fact that certain chemistry experiments, such as titrations, where you're trying to mix just enough acid in to see what the pH of a mixture is, it's a bit of an art as well as a science to get this thing to work exactly right. So that's the disadvantage. You don't get to see it directly. The advantage is, however, that you can do lots and lots of experiments over and over again and actually learn at a more rapid pace. I myself, when I was an undergraduate student at the University of Illinois, worked on a system called the Plato computer system. 25 years ago, they used these funny touchscreen orange plasma computers, And, in fact, they were 10 years ahead of their time back then. Now, of course, they're probably 8 years behind the times. But nonetheless, that's actually how I learned aromatic organic synthesis. That is synthesis in organic chemistry, where you work with lots of aromatic compounds. These are things like benzene and toluene and xylene and things like that. And that is its own branch of synthesis. And it's kind of difficult to understand how to make one molecule from the other. But when you do it virtually, I found it very useful. To that end, the article goes on to state that on the 2005 administration of the Advanced Placement Biology exam, for example, 61% of students nationwide earned a qualifying score of 3 or above on the AP's 5-point system. Yet, 71% of students who took the AP Biology online through Florida's virtual school and 80% of students who took it from a virtual another virtual high school earned a 3 or higher on that particular test. So maybe there is a place for this sort of thing in the educational system. Okay, along to something that is perhaps more relevant to my life, because I've got a 12-year-old who's on the verge of puberty, who's driving me nuts at home on a regular basis. In an article from October 17th in the New York Times by Darshak M. Sagavi, entitled Preschool Puberty and Search for the Causes. So there is a pathology called precocious puberty, where a problem with the endocrine system, with the hypothalamus, the pituitary gland, actually causes preschool kids to go through puberty early. And I'm not talking about 11 or 12. I'm talking about 4, 5, and 6. And, in fact, that is a completely different pathology. But what researchers often find is small outbreaks of kids that go through puberty prematurely. And parents often think their children grow up too quickly, according to the article, which I agree with, but few are prepared for the problem that Dr. Michael Dedekian and his colleagues at the University of Massachusetts Medical School reported recently. At an annual pediatric academic society meeting in May in San Francisco, they presented a report that described how a preschool-age girl and her kindergarten-age brother mysteriously began growing pubic hair. These cases are not isolated. In 2004, a pediatric endocrinologist from San Diego reported a similar cluster of 5 children. Now, they tend to believe that these are due to exposure to chemicals. So let me see if I can find the example here. Here's a particularly interesting one. In a 1998 paper from the Journal of Clinical Pediatrics, Dr. Chandra Tiwari, the former chief of pediatric endocrinology at the Brooke Army Medical Center in Texas, reported an outbreak of early breast development in 4 young African-American girls who used shampoos that contained estrogen and placental extract. Obviously, placentas are riddled with estrogen-like hormones. The early puberty reversed once the shampoo was stopped. And in fact, these kinds of shampoos don't have an adverse effect on adults who have higher hormone levels. But this sort of thing, they've also found them with tree oil extracts as well that exhibit similar symptoms. And a lot of things that naturally occur, such as the estrogen mimics in soybeans. For example, in Asia, they found that people that eat way too much tofu, and when I say way too much tofu, I mean much more tofu than I typically eat, and I'm a big fan of tofu. They point out that these estrogen mimics called phytoestrogens can actually cause male breast enlargement. Another example from the same article showed that kids went through premature puberty because they had testosterone levels 100 times normal because they came in normal contact with their father who was using testosterone cream. So if you ever see this sort of thing, you might want to talk to your doctor about it. It may not be this precocious puberty that happens every once in a while. It may be exposure to chemicals now that we're putting more and more very strong chemicals in nutrition supplements that are not regulated by the FDA. So we need to take a quick break here, but when we come back, we'll be talking to Nick Hudd about the chemistry of the origin of life. You're listening to Inside the Black Box on Radio Sandy Springs, 1620 on your AM dial and RadioSandySprings.com. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to Inside the Black Box, where today we'll be discussing the chemistry of the origin of life with our guest, Professor Nick Hudd from the School of Chemistry and Biochemistry, right? Let me get that right, at the Georgia Institute of Technology. Dr. Nick Hudd received his B.S. and Ph. degrees in chemistry from Loyola Marymount University and the University of California at Davis, respectively. And he's going to discuss today the origin of life on Earth and his recent work on a new type of molecule called a molecular midwife. These new molecules appear to increase the rate of DNA formation and synthesis from RNA, which scientists believe was the first self-replicating molecule on Earth. The ability of molecules to copy themselves, this concept of self-replication, is critical to all life. And this discovery is an important step in the effort to trace the evolution of life to the very beginning of the earliest self-replicating molecules, which may have been responsible for life. And the results of his recent work were reported in the April 2nd edition of the German chemistry journal Angewandte Chemie, which actually means applied chemistry. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's a very standard chemistry journal in the community, yes.
Right, so we read it. I just think that is what you're doing really applied? I guess it is, in a sense.
Yeah, but the name maybe is... doesn't represent everything that is in the journal. It's a pretty broad chemistry journal.
Okay, so Nick, welcome to the program.
Thanks, nice to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you here. You're actually the third person from the School of Chemistry and Biology we've had before. Larry Bottomley's been on the program, as well as Julia Kobanek, who has a joint appointment in chemistry and biochemistry. And if there's one thing I've learned about you guys from chemistry and biochemistry, you're all smartasses. And I know a lot of people who know Nick. I've known Nick for a while. Seems like a quiet, very unassuming guy. But I know you have that streak in you as well, because when I was slurping a picture for our website, from your website, I noticed the little mouse over image thing that you did. Did you do that, or did somebody?
Yes, I did. It took me longer than I'd like to admit to learn the HTML that was required to do that.
So basically you have two images, one that gets loaded previously, and then on a mouse over that image, it switches to another image. So you have one of you sort of with a neutral look on your face and one with this smile.
Yes.
And you move it over your face, and it looks very strange.
Yes.
So you fit in well over in chemistry.
Thank you.
So today we're here to talk about the chemistry of the origin of life. And perhaps before we get into molecular midwives and DNA synthesis, you might want to talk a little bit about the basic chemistry of RNA, DNA, and peptides, and how that's related to the origin of life.
Well, sure. I think everybody has heard about DNA, and we know that DNA is this genetic material which codes for every part of every living organism. And when we think about DNA, we think about it as this code, and what is that code? What does that mean? Well, it's coding for proteins. Proteins are another great class of polymers within living organisms. They're made up of amino acids. That's the elemental building block of a protein. And the DNA sequence is actually coding for how these amino acids are stitched together to make this other polymer called a protein. So those are the two major classes, I would say, of molecules or polymers in life.
Right, and basically in DNA, and this is an oversimplification because huge strands of DNA aren't used. We learned that from some guests from the biology department previously. And there are lots of parts of DNA that signal the end of a protein, the beginning of a protein, things that will upregulate the concentration of that protein, downregulate it. But in its simplest form, every triplet of these DNA segments codes for an amino acid, more or less. So it really
exactly.
is a fairly simple mapping from one to the other.
Yes.
Okay, so we have DNA, and DNA holds the sequence of proteins that we need for life.
Yes, and then there's an intermediary molecule between the DNA and the protein, which is RNA. And chemically, it's very similar, of course, as just the name implies. We have DNA being deoxyribonucleic acid, and then we just have ribonucleic acid, very close chemically. But their roles are quite different in that RNA is what is read, actually, when proteins are made. And so the first step, actually, in making a protein is to transcribe the DNA into a piece of RNA, and then, as we say, to translate the RNA, actually, into the protein. So we have this intermediate molecule.
It's early in the morning.
Yes,
it's okay.
Yes, I'm getting stuck on some easy words here, which has been now seen to grow in importance in the cell and all the roles that it's been found to be doing lately. Before, people really used to think about DNA as the code, proteins doing all of the work, and RNA merely as this messenger. In fact, there's a whole class of RNA called messenger RNA. But now we're finding that RNA is popping up all over the place.
Right, and let me just say, because I actually work on RNA modeling with a colleague who's a mutual friend of ours, Steve Harvey, in the biology department. We understand diddly squat about RNA. Nick mentioned before that instead of RNA, DNA is deoxy. So you pull one oxygen off of this molecule. It's literally an oxygen-hydrogen group the way it's on there. And it drastically changes the way it works. You don't get this nice double helix that always forms and then supercoils in the nucleus of your cells. It can form a helix, a single helix, stems, loops, all sorts of weird stuff that allow it to be flexible enough to interact with DNA, translate the signal, and then go off and help proteins be synthesized. And I'll tell you, it's just a nightmare compared to DNA. We're still figuring out things every single day about RNA. Okay, so RNA translates it to the protein.
Yes.
Okay.
And in terms of the origin of life, our theories, our present theories on the origin of life were changed dramatically about 25 years ago when it was discovered that RNA can act as an enzyme. That is, that RNA can catalyze reactions. And before that time, it was believed that only proteins were catalyzing reactions within living cells. And this is extremely important because when we think about the essence of life, well, if we think about life in the simplest terms, we know that to have life, we need information. We need to have that information transferred as an organism is being self-replicated. And also what we need is we need chemical catalysis, because in all of life, we are taking nutrients in and we are synthesizing new molecules from them. And in order to do that, you need chemical catalysis. So we had believed that that was all being done by proteins, and everything changes when you find out that RNA can do that. And this actually was something that had implications of the origin of life, because there was this chicken and egg paradox about what came first, say DNA or proteins.
And let's address that very chicken and egg paradox. Yes. After we take a brief break, you're listening to Inside the Black Box on Radio Sandy Springs, 1620 on your AM dial and RadioSandySprings.com. Welcome back to Inside the Black Box here on Radio Sandy Springs. We're talking with Professor Nick Hudd about the chemistry of the origin of life. And just before the break, we were talking about the different molecules, proteins, RNA, and DNA, and segueing into this chicken and egg problem of which came first.
So the problem is that we know that life needs to have an information storage for the molecules that are going to make up a cell, and we know that that's contained in DNA. But in order to make those molecules, we need these proteins that can perform catalytic reactions. And so both are needed in the cell. And what we also know is that in order to make a protein, you need the DNA to code for the protein. But to make the DNA, you need that enzyme, a type of protein enzyme that will make the DNA. So they're dependent on each other. Then the question comes, which came first, the protein or the DNA? And this was a long-standing paradox. And then again, about 25 years ago, there was the discovery made that RNA could catalyze chemical reactions. So now RNA, being a molecule that is very similar to DNA, which can store information, and also now if we say that RNA can catalyze reactions, it's similar then to proteins, and then you say here's one molecule that within that one molecule you'll have what are both the essential components for life, that is information storage and chemical catalysis. So then the hypothesis gained a lot of speed that RNA could have been the first molecule of life, that it could have served both purposes, those of what DNA does now and those of what proteins do now, and in a sense invented proteins and DNA at some point.
So then my next obvious question is, where did we get the RNA?
So that becomes the next issue to tackle then. Okay. If we believe that RNA was the first molecule that somehow RNA self-replicated, it begs the question, where did RNA come from?
Right.
And that is exactly what we're working on in my lab. How do we get these first polymers? What we do know about original life chemistry right now is that the building blocks of RNA, proteins, another whole class of molecules we haven't talked about, which are polysaccharides, which many people think about.
Right, so essentially sugars, like starch.
Absolutely.
Which, in fact, DNA and RNA technically
they
are.
They have those in there, exactly. Yeah. What we know is that the building blocks, these units that are then connected together to make polymers, these are relatively easy to make in reactions that we believe would have been occurring on the Earth, say, about 4 billion years ago. That is, we know that the building blocks of proteins, the amino acids, those can be made very easily. In DNA and RNA, there's really three components to them. There are the bases, and I'm sure most of the listeners are familiar with the idea about DNA where you have A pairing with T and G pairing with C. That's the part of the genetic code. And when you think about the DNA molecule, those pieces that are pairing together, we call those the bases. And those can be made under relatively simple reactions. Sugars as well. And we know from meteors that have fallen to the Earth from outer space that you can actually find molecules like this. These are the building blocks. You're not finding RNA, DNA, or proteins, but you're finding the building blocks of them. So in a sense, with respect to original life work, we have an approach to a theory coming from two sides of how life started. We know that we can make a pool of building blocks, and we know if those can get together and make a polymer like RNA, then those can somehow self-replicate. But the key now is, how do you take those building blocks and connect them together into the right polymer?
But you're saying something that's actually kind of interesting to me. When we think of a sugar, we know that organisms know how to synthesize sugars. They're very important. They not only, for example, in plants, cellulose for the cell wall, the sugar that's produced in all sorts of starches and corn and things like that. You need to make them for DNA because that's actually a five-membered sugar, this ribose. So are you saying that, you know, given just normal conditions sitting out there in the environment, that we can actually get these sugars being synthesized?
Well, I would say not today.
Okay.
So what we have to think about is that the chemistry, the environment, the atmosphere, the temperature, everything on Earth was very different 4 billion years ago.
Right.
When the elements of life were coming together. What we know is that the chemistry to make up, say, the bases of RNA, that uses hydrogen cyanide. And we know that hydrogen cyanide, that is something that, you know, today we don't have falling from the sky in our atmosphere.
Gratefully.
Right, because that would be pretty toxic. But at one point, it probably was. Okay. In fact, we know from outer space looking at planets that there are ones that are rich in this in their atmosphere.
Right. So to put this in perspective, hydrogen cyanide is the gas that is used in gas chambers, essentially. It breaks down the blood gas barrier in your lungs, and you essentially drown in your own blood. It's a nasty, nasty thing.
Yes, but when you put it into high concentrations, it will actually spontaneously synthesize adenine, which is one of the building blocks of RNA.
Right.
And so in that way, it's a very good thing.
Wow.
And another one that people might be familiar with and hearing about is a molecule called formaldehyde, which is where if you want to preserve a biological specimen, the classic thing is to dunk it in some formaldehyde, right? If you want some embalming fluid, a key ingredient, it's going to be formaldehyde. But now if you take formaldehyde and you concentrate it and you add in a little bit of calcium under basic conditions, that is a little bit of a high pH, you'll spontaneously form sugars. So this is very simple chemistry. And we know, again, from what we've done with astronomy, that formaldehyde is out there in outer space. And so we believe that it was present on the early Earth, and these reactions were there to make these building blocks of life
that we know today.
So the building blocks, which in my field of polymer chemistry we call the monomers, it's just one unit, and that's this adenine cysteine for RNA and DNA, and of course there are other sugars for starches and things like that. You can make the monomers. So then the next question is, how do you get those to link together and form this polymer of RNA?
That's exactly right. That's a big issue. How do we get these molecules to stitch together? And there's been a number of theories out there. For probably 50 years, there's been a theory that surfaces, inorganic surfaces, like clays that people would be familiar with, that maybe those played a role. And the reason for that is that if you have these monomers in solution, it's quite dilute. Mm-hmm. And you can imagine then if they're in a pool and you dry the pool out, then they will dry down and stick to the surface. So that's one way to concentrate them. And when you're concentrating them and heating them up, some reactions can occur that can actually stitch them together.
Right.
We've actually been exploring some other ways to do it.
Right. So when you say inorganic, of course, we mean things that aren't predominantly made up of carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen. Things like silicon oxides in these clays.
Yes.
And we commonly use those as catalysts for synthetic polymers.
Exactly. That's why these ideas are pretty attractive.
Yeah. It's not certainly unheard of. And let's explore that further after this upcoming break. You're listening to Inside the Black Box on Radio Sandy Springs, 1620 AM and RadioSandySprings.com. Welcome back to Inside the Black Box, where we're talking with Professor Nick Hudd from Georgia Tech about the chemistry of the origin of life. And just before the break, we were talking about this catalytic synthesis of these sugars to form RNA. And yet again, just to put it in perspective, when we think of chemistry, we think if we mix two things together, they react, form something new. The truth is most interesting chemistry, whether it's synthetic chemistry or especially biochemistry, involves these catalysts, or in biology speak, it's enzymes. Enzymes are essentially the biological version of what we call in the synthetic world catalysts. And these are molecules that participate in the reaction but are not consumed. Think of them as the helpers sort of thing, that they get the two things together. They can take the form of anything from a simple metal surface like nickel to complex enzymes to some of the molecules that Nick's going to talk about right now. So.
Yes. So when we think about catalysts as well, just exactly what you said is true, that they can bring together two molecules that we want to react with each other. And that's a very important part of, say, enzymes. They're increasing the local concentration, you might say, of two molecules. You want them to react, and if they're in solution and it's a dilute solution, then the probability that they're next to each other and that they can form a chemical bond with each other is quite low. So a lot of what a catalyst does, for example, a surface catalyst where two molecules would stick to the surface, is very simple in the idea that it's just bringing the molecules within close proximity to each other. And then the other thing, too, is to what we call perform the chemical step, that is, help make that bond form. So surfaces are pretty good at doing this, but they're not very selective. That's a problem. And when we think about the origin of life, when we think about prebiotic chemistry, and as I mentioned, it's quite easy to form molecules such as the bases of RNA and the sugars that are in RNA and polysaccharides and amino acids. It was a very, very rich chemistry. So we would have had this pool of molecules that not only contained the building blocks of life, but would have contained a lot more than that, a lot of molecules that were not necessarily the ones that we wanted to connect into the polymers that would be RNA. So a big issue then is selectivity. How do we select out those molecules that are going to make RNA? And a theory that we've put forth from my laboratory that we're working on is that within this pool of molecules, there were molecules that actually helped assemble the RNA. And these are molecules that we call molecular midwives. We use that term because, just as you said, a catalyst helps a reaction occur, but it doesn't get consumed by that. Another thing to think about is that when a catalyst helps two molecules react with each other to form a bond between those two molecules, it itself does not become linked to those molecules in the final stages. It's not covalently bound, as we would say. It's not connected. That is, that once those two molecules are connected together, they can leave. They can drift away, if you will, from that catalyst. And that's important because in the RNA, we want to stitch together the building blocks. It'd be good to have a way to help stitch together these building blocks, but we don't want to have, say, them stuck to a surface. And that's one thing that I've always had a problem with, the idea of surfaces and drying things down. When you do that, these molecules tend to get stuck. It's very difficult to take them off. So our idea actually comes about from a class of molecules that's well known in biochemistry that are very, very useful, important molecules. They're called intercalators. Intercalators are molecules that slip in between the base pairs of DNA. And if you will, imagine in your mind the DNA duplex, that double helix, right, this icon of modern science. And you think about the base pairs that are in the center there that are they're stacking on. They're these planar molecules stacking on each other. What you can imagine is just unwinding that duplex a little bit to where you have a space in between those stacked base pairs, and you can slip a molecule in between there. We do this all the time in the laboratory. If we want to image DNA, if we want to see it in, say, a gel, if we're running a gel, and we all know that you can separate DNA based upon its size by running it through something that looks like a piece of Jell-O. But in order to image that molecule, we typically take small molecules, these intercalators, that when they bind to DNA, they fluoresce. And when they bind, that is, we can shine a UV light on them and visible light comes out, these small molecules are intercalating the DNA. Also, a whole class of drugs that are used to treat cancer, for example, that they intercalate DNA as well. So this is a phenomenon that's ubiquitous now in modern chemistry dealing with nucleic acids. It's everywhere. And so our idea is that why wouldn't there have been some small molecules in that prebiotic solution that also intercalated RNA? So, and you can turn the problem around. You can say, well, if we have DNA that's already formed and these small molecules bind to DNA, then if you had these small molecules and you had the building blocks of DNA, they could bind to this molecule as well, stack with it, and start to make a structure that looks like RNA. And all you need to do then is to connect those molecules into the polymer. This idea of having small molecules in solution that come together and spontaneously make what is a multi-molecular assembly is what we call self-assembly. And this is now a whole established area of chemistry that's very important, which is how we make more complex molecules starting with simple building blocks, right? And so our idea is that life was doing this from the start.
Right, and self-assembly is something our listeners see every single day. It doesn't have to occur in biological things. For example, every time you put some Dawn in your dishwasher or in your sink to take the grease away from dishes, it's essentially self-assembling this micellar structure that has nice polar water-soluble groups on the outside, greasy groups that will solubilize the grease on the inside. And in fact, this was decades ago when we first took the very first, I think it was lecithin from soybeans, and made a bilayer, which is essentially what the capsule that holds a cell together looks like. We were all excited. We thought 2 years from now we're going to be making artificial cells. It's been, 50, 60 years, and we're still working on this. But self-assembly is important in everything from washing your dishes to nanotechnology. So this is a very general thing. So that seems to be the key. And right after this break, we'll talk about how these molecular midwives help with the synthesis of RNA and DNA. You're listening to Inside the Black Box on Radio Sandy Springs, 1620 on your AM dial and RadioSandySprings.com. Welcome back to Inside the Black Box here on Radio Sandy Springs, where we're talking with Professor Nick Hudd about the chemistry of the origin of life. And we just started talking about these molecules that he's researching called molecular midwives that stick in between the bases in DNA, RNA, and somehow may help improve the rate of synthesis of these. Is that it?
Absolutely. And again, the problem that we're trying to solve here is if you have a mixture, a complex mixture of the building blocks of life, how would these have come together to make polymers? And our idea that we're pursuing, as we mentioned before the break, is this idea of self-assembly. In essence, self-assembly means that you have molecules that, because of their molecular interactions, the way that they adhere to each other, that they preferentially stick and form formations with each other rather than stay in the solution that is solvated by, say, water or whatever solvent you're working in. And as you mentioned, this is something that happens when you put your soap into your dishwater and mix it up and you make bubbles. Those are perfect examples of self-assembly, molecules, that small molecules coming together, making what you might say as more complex assemblies. It's interesting that you point that out about the dish soap and making these, because that's also believed to be the case for the origin of life, that there would have been these lipid molecules around. Mm-hmm. Lipids are the molecules that are in the membranes of cells that we know today. Mm-hmm. And it's a beautiful example that if you have these, they themselves will assemble into cellular-like compartments.
Right. And actually, so we do some transdermal drug delivery with Mark Prausnitz at Georgia Tech, and we've done... I guess what you would call vesicles, which are essentially these bags with a lipid membrane. And it's hard to make them in a well-characterized environment to make sure that they only have one layer of the lipid bilayer and that they're of a certain size. That requires a little interesting chemistry and physics. But to be honest, to just make them, you literally throw them in solution. It's nice to adjust the pH to just the right point and mix them together. And you will form lipid bilayers if you actually do that.
Yes. And if you want to encapsulate something into these lipid bilayers, a very easy way to do it is to take these lipids. Again, as we're discussing these, a lipid is very much like a soap molecule. That is, that you have on one end a charged group, say a negatively charged group that is very soluble in water, and that's connected to a chain that is typically what we would call a hydrophobic molecule that doesn't like to be in water. And so these will associate, and so that they make these vesicles. And one way that you can make these vesicles is you can have a solution and you can dry it down onto a surface, and then you add water back. And these kind of roll up on themselves and make these vessels. Mm-hmm. And that's one way that it's made, that these vesicles are made today to encapsulate drugs for delivery, simply to dry them down and then take a solution with, say, the drug you want to deliver and pour them onto the surface. And we believe that in Origin of Life, something very similar could have been the mechanism by which the first cells formed. One thing that's very interesting about Origin of Life chemistry is that the chemistry of stitching together these monomers we've been talking about, these reactions are generally called condensation reactions, where we're bringing together molecules to make polymers. And something that is in common with this is that the chemical reaction that occurs, say as we're taking a sugar and we're connecting it to a base to make what we call a nucleoside of RNA, that reaction there eliminates a water molecule. Now, this is also the case when we're stitching together amino acids to make a protein. We take two amino acids, we react them together to form what we call a peptide bond. And so we're going to make the polymer. It's a polypeptide, which is a protein is. And that also eliminates water. If we want to make a polysaccharide, we take sugars and we link them together. We make what is called an acetyl bond. These are very different bonds from, say, the peptide bond or the glycosidic bond that I talked about with the RNA, except that what's in common is that they're eliminating water. Water comes off. And as you might imagine, that if this is a chemical reaction, that water is given off when this happens, it's a reaction that will be promoted if you are drying molecules. So if you put these molecules out and you put them in the hot sun and they start to dry out, you will make some type of connections there that would be these polymers. And so this has caused many of us in the Origin of Life field to believe that the chemistry of taking these monomers, these building blocks, and putting them together in the polymers was no doubt promoted by day-night cycles. That is, heating during the day under the hot sun, maybe drying out on a rock, and then in the nighttime having it rain, being cooler, and adding water back. Mm-hmm. And this would fit perfectly with this whole vesicle idea, because during the daytime, if you heated and dried things onto a surface, and you would get a layer of these lipid-like molecules, and when the rain hit it on the next, mm-hmm. say, evening when it was cool, you would spontaneously get cells forming.
Wow. That's something that we encounter, for example, when we make nylon. Nylon, it's no coincidence, it mimics some of the properties of silk. It actually has a similar structure. It is this polyamide. And, in fact, removing the water is the toughest part. That's where we spent most of our time because it's a condensation reaction as well. So let me ask you about these molecular midwives that you have.
Yes.
So have you seen these things in a test tube accelerate these RNA reactions?
Oh, absolutely. What we have done is we've made some, say, test experiments where we take some of the building blocks of RNA or DNA, and we measure this kind of background reaction. How much do they react on their own? And then we add in these midwife molecules, and we do another measurement, and we see what has been the acceleration of this reaction. And right now, we've got it up to about a 10,000-fold increase.
That's amazing.
Over what you get in the background. And so it's working 10 times as well, 10,000 times as well in the presence of the molecular midwife.
Right. And you call them molecular midwives because they're sort of the helper in the reaction, just like a midwife helps with the birthing process.
Exactly. We needed a term, and we wanted a general term that would say that these are molecules that help give birth to another molecule,
right.
But when that molecule has reached a stage where it can survive on its own, then these are no longer needed. They can leave. Right?
Okay.
And that was the idea behind using that term.
Oh, okay. But then, of course, the question we were talking about over the break, why do we have midwives and no mid-husbands, and why is there animal husbandry but no midwifery?
I think we have to ask our own wives about that one.
Now, what is the term you use when you're watching the kids that your wife does not like?
Oh, that's when I say I'm going to do my husbandly duties.
I thought you said animal husbandry duties, which is appropriate given my kids.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right, so we'll continue talking about these molecular midwives when we come back from the break in just a minute. You're listening to Inside the Black Box on Radio Sandy Springs, 1620 AM and RadioSandySprings.com. Welcome back to Inside the Black Box here on Radio Sandy Springs, where we're talking with Professor Nick Hudd about the chemistry of the origin of life. And just before the break, Nick was telling us that these molecular midwife chemicals can accelerate the synthesis of RNA, one of the important building blocks for life, by a factor of 10,000.
Yes.
That's amazing. So what do these molecules look like? What are their structures? Are they big? Are they small? Are they complex? Are they simple?
Well, what they look like, let's see.
Is tough on radio.
Yeah, it's a little tough. That. You know, I always like to draw things out of my hands, but we're not going to be able to do that on radio with any effectiveness. If we think about the bases of RNA or of DNA, what we know is that let's say we have an A and a T pairing together.
Mm-hmm.
The T is a molecule that the base has six atoms in a ring structure. So anybody can go look up that. And the A, which is a purine, has a fused five-membered ring and a six-membered ring. And so these pair with each other and make a larger planar structure. The key of the molecular midwife is that its size and shape is exactly that of a base pair.
Ah, okay.
And that is the key about this self-assembly here, which is that these midwives are providing surfaces which allow the bases to stack on them and to form the assemblies that they would form within a piece of DNA or RNA.
Okay, so they essentially mimic this stacking that you see in RNA and DNA.
Absolutely.
Okay. So, and that's often the case, though.
Absolutely. You know, it's what we call a templating reaction.
Right. Okay, so basically you've showed me two very interesting new building steps in the origin of life from the chemistry perspective. One, the fact that sugars, when you've got things like cyanides around and the basic monomers, can be formed quite easily. And now there are helper molecules that can increase the synthesis of RNA 10,000-fold.
Yes.
So you've made a really good case to me about how things actually could have come from this molecular soup in the primordial Earth 4 to 5 billion years ago. But obviously a lot of people don't share your views. You were mentioning you get some emails, you know, folks that have a more metaphysical, spiritual view of the origin of life. I mean, do people get on your case about this very interesting research?
Well, sometimes they do. But, you know, we're all entitled to our own beliefs, and typically I'm open to having discussions to educate them about the scientific perspectives mm-hmm. of this problem. Mm-hmm. And it is a problem of chemistry is what it really comes down
right.
to.
Right. So you're not talking to the church auxiliary on a regular basis?
No, but I'm open.
Okay. So you are willing to come out to the local church and talk to them about that sort of thing. And basically you were telling me before that you do occasionally get a heated email.
Yes, and that's where I find the delete key is,
okay.
is very useful.
Well, there you go. So let's recap as we're closing the show about what we've learned today. So the first thing that I know I learned that was very interesting is that these building blocks of life, these sugars, can sort of spontaneously form under the right conditions. And some of those conditions include lots of cyanide floating around like we did in the primordial
right.
Earth.
And conditions that we know exist even today on mm-hmm. other planets in our solar system.
Oh, okay, great. And certainly there was no short of heat or energy to get these things going. A lot of volcanic activity.
Absolutely.
Like that. Right. Okay, then the other thing is we learned about these lovely chemicals called molecular midwives that will speed up RNA synthesis 10,000-fold.
Yes.
That's pretty amazing. And actually, if you want to know anything more about these sorts of molecules, on the radio station website, if you go to today's show, there is a link to Georgia Tech that has a brief description and a couple interesting videos describing how this happens, right?
Right. I'm there talking about the idea even more.
Yeah. Yeah. I saw the video of you talking about it, but I didn't actually see the video of showing how the molecules work.
Well,
so I should take a look at that.
Yeah, there's actually an animated sequence showing this right. idea of a primordial soup with molecules there. And if you click through it, it gives you an explanation of each stage, and it shows you the sun coming up and the pool drying down and
wow.
the molecules coming together. It's actually done at the Georgia Tech. They have animators there on staff to help uh-huh. with the website, and they did a terrific job, I think.
Wow. So it goes back to the first news story we started with. The whole virtual lab might be the way to go.
It kind of shows you it that way.
The virtual origin of life. And then in addition to that, you mentioned there's a book that can outline some of these theories.
Yeah, there's a very nice book. I've used it for a class that I taught at Georgia Tech on the origin of life. Any of our listeners should feel free to read this book because it is a very much a beginner's guide to the origin of life. It's called The Beginnings. It's called Life's Origins, The Beginning of Biological Evolution. It's by my good friend J. William Schoff. That's the last name is S-C-H-O-P-F. He is at UCLA, and his I think big claim to fame is that he actually is the discoverer of the oldest fossils on Earth. And if you talk about a big scientific discovery, this is one of them because he dated these fossils to be 3.5 billion years old. And so in a sense, he has dated how old life is on Earth.
So he's dated the oldest fossils on Earth. We're
yes.
not talking about his ex-girlfriend here, are we?
Sorry, no.
I couldn't resist that one. Okay. So what we will do is we'll go ahead and I'll put a link to that
yes.
where you can find that book on the website as well. And then, of course, the other thing I learned is a catchy phrase to describe me having to babysit the kids, animal husbandry. That
yes.
certainly works for me.
Nice.
All right. So, Nick, thank you very much for being on the program.
You're very welcome.
All right. So I just want to point out that our guest from 2 weeks ago, mathematician and comedian Lou Lefton, will be appearing with me on, let's see, October 29th in front of the Britain Dormitories on the east side of campus. That's a 7 p.m. show on Sunday. And, in fact, Mark Perlow, who was a guest talking about infertility from Georgia Reproductive Specialist, he and I will be appearing on the 2nd, November 2nd in the evening, probably 6 o'clock at Northside Hospital. On behalf of Resolve, the national support group for infertile couples, he'll be talking about treatment options. I'll be making cheesy jokes about awkward moments in the collection room. Other than that, we'll see you next week. Coming up is How Does Your Garden Grow with Pat Thurnell, with guest Liz Edmondson talking about growing camellias. We'll see you next week on Inside the Black Box on Radio Sandy Springs.